Welcome back to the deep dive. Today we are taking on a giant. And I don't just mean a giant of philosophy. I mean a guy whose ideas are basically the operating system for the modern Western world.
Oh, absolutely.
We're talking about John Locke.
Yeah.
And usually, when you hear the name John Locke, you immediately think,
Life, liberty, and property.
exactly, think of the American Revolution, Thomas Jefferson, the Declaration of Independence, the whole political side of
Yeah,
things.
he is the rights guy. You learn the slogan in school, you check the box that says father of liberalism, and you just move on.
Right, but what we have today is a fascinating lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes on the history of philosophy. And he paints a much bigger, much more intricate picture for us.
He really does.
It turns out you can't really understand Locke's politics unless you understand his obsession with the human brain, specifically how we know what we know.
That's right. It's an interconnected web. It's a bit like, looking at a finished skyscraper and
Right.
completely forgetting about the engineering that keeps it standing.
Yeah.
We tend to focus on the facade, right?
Yeah.
The politics. But Locke's work is actually a massive, unified system. Dr. Holmes argues that Locke's political theories are really just the final application of his epistemology.
His theory of knowledge.
Exactly. It starts with how we process evidence in our minds and ends with why we have the moral right to overthrow a government.
So the mission for us today is to unpack that web. We're going to trace the thread from the very bottom to the top. We're going to see how Locke's rule of reason dictates everything. I mean, everything. From how he reads the Bible to how he defines a free society.
It's a huge scope.
It is. And I have to say, looking at the source material, Locke's view on faith is it's surprisingly technical. It's almost like he's trying to code religion into a computer program.
Is technical, yeah. But for Locke, it was absolutely essential. If I had to boil Locke down to a single bumper sticker, it would be the phrase Dr. Holmes highlighted right at the start of his lecture. We must proportion our belief to the evidence.
Proportion belief to the evidence. That sounds so sensible, doesn't it? Like something a scientist would say on a panel today.
Precisely. Locke is what we call an evidentialist. And this brings us to our first big topic, really, the reasonable believer. You see, Locke didn't think you could separate the believer from the citizen.
Right.
He applies the exact same rigorous standards to religion that he applies to everything else in life.
So let's dig into that, because usually we think of faith and reason as opposites, right? Like faith is what you feel, reason is what you prove. You have faith or you have logic.
The classic divide.
Yeah, but Locke says, well, not so fast.
No, not at all. In fact, Dr. Holmes points out that for Locke, revelation like the Bible is defined as the addition of new propositions to the mind.
Propositions. That is a very specific word. It's not a feeling. It's not a vibe. It's data.
It is data. Think of it this way. Reason is the hardware we're born with, right?
Right.
It allows us to judge certainty and probability based on our natural experience in the world.
Right.
Revelation is a software update containing new information, new propositions that we just couldn't figure out on our own.
I really like that analogy. So God sends a software update with things we couldn't deduce, like the resurrection or the nature of the afterlife.
Exactly.
But here's the catch, and Dr. Holmes makes a very big deal of this in the lecture. The update cannot crash the hardware.
That is the crucial point. Locke argues that revelation can go beyond reason. It can tell us things we couldn't deduce by logic alone, but it can never contradict reason.
So if you get a revelation that says 2 + 2 = 5,
Then it's not a revelation, because God is rational and does not contradict himself. Since God created our reasoning faculties and God is the author of revelation, the two simply cannot be in conflict. Reason is the judge of whether the revelation is authentic.
this leads to a definition of faith that I found really interesting when reviewing the source. Locke says faith is assent to propositions on the credit of the proposer.
Yes, it is an intellectual act. You aren't believing because of a warm, fuzzy feeling. You're believing because you have weighed the evidence, determined that the message actually comes from God, and you trust God's testimony.
It's like trusting a witness in court.
That's a great way to put it. Break that down a bit more.
Well, imagine a jury. They didn't see the crime happen, right? They have no direct knowledge of the event. But if a witness takes the stand who is proven to be reliable, honest, and in a position to know the truth.
The jury is rational to accept their testimony.
Exactly. They assent on the credit of the proposer. So for Locke, God is the ultimate expert witness.
Right. And because we know God is infallible, we accept the testimony. But we first have to use reason to verify that the witness actually is God.
Which brings us to the villain of Locke's story. If he loves reason and evidence so much, What does he hate? He seems to be waging this constant intellectual war against something very specific in his writing.
He is. He absolutely hates enthusiasm.
Now, we really need to clarify this for you listening, because today, being enthusiastic is a good thing. Like, I'm enthusiastic about this deep dive.
Right, right.
But Locke didn't mean it that way, did he?
No, not at all. In the 17th century, enthusiasm was a specific, somewhat derogatory term for people who claimed to have a private inner light.
Okay.
Think of the early Quakers, or the Pietists, or various radical sects of that era. These were people who said, God spoke to me directly, and I just know it's true because I feel it in my soul.
And Locke is sitting there going, show me the receipts.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
He disliked it because it's completely subjective. If your truth comes from a private inner light, I can't check it with my reason. It's not public. And for Locke, if it's not rational and public, it's dangerous. It bypasses the entire mechanism of truth.
And this isn't just some abstract philosophical beef either. This is where the history gets really heavy. Dr. Holmes shares a story in his lecture about why this mattered so much to Locke. It wasn't just about winning a debate club argument. It was about stopping real violence.
That's exactly right. We have to remember the historical context here. This is late 17th century England. You've had civil wars, brutal religious conflict between Catholics and Protestants, and heavy, heavy persecution. Holmes mentions something called the 5 Mile Act.
Which sounds like a charity fun run, but definitely wasn't.
No, it was very dark. It was a law that said dissenters, basically anyone who wasn't part of the official Church of England, like Baptists or Presbyterians, were forbidden from worshiping within 5 miles of a corporate town or any place where they had previously preached.
They literally banished them to the countryside.
They did. And Dr. Holmes actually has a personal connection to this history, which was fascinating to hear. He grew up in Dover, England, in a Baptist family.
Oh, wow.
And he recounts how, even the 20th century, his church had a tradition on Good Friday where the whole congregation would walk 5 or 6 miles out to a tiny village called Eythorne.
That's incredible. So they were reenacting the trek their ancestors had to make just to go to church legally.
Exactly. Holmes describes it so vividly. He says people would converge on this tiny village from all the surrounding towns, Canterbury, Folkestone, Dover, walking down the spokes of the wheel to get to the hub at Eythorne.
Wow.
And Holmes realized later in life that this tradition wasn't just a nice spring hike. It was a living memory of that persecution.
That really drives it home. When Locke writes his letter on toleration, he's not just trying to be a nice, modern guy. He's looking at a world where power politics forces grandmothers to walk 6 miles to pray, or worse, throws them in a dungeon.
Precisely. Locke saw enthusiasm and religious intolerance as two sides of the same coin, irrational passion. He believed the only alternative to power politics and violence was the rule of reason.
Because reason is neutral.
Right. If we all agree to use reason, we can tolerate each other because we're operating on the same playing field. If I can't convince you with evidence, I certainly can't convince you with a sword.
So reason isn't just about thinking clearly. It's about peace. It's the treaty that keeps us from killing each other over what we believe.
Well put. It is the neutral ground.
Okay, so let's pivot to the next layer of Locke's web, ethics. How do we know right from wrong? Now, I know Locke is the blank slate guy, tabula rasa.
Yes, the empiricist.
Right. We aren't born with any innate ideas. So if we don't have a moral compass installed at the factory, how do we get one?
Locke says we have to build it. Since we have no innate ideas, all our knowledge comes from experience, sensation, and reflection. And Dr. Holmes outlines three distinct ways Locke thinks we acquire moral knowledge.
All right, lay them on me.
The first is what he calls demonstration. This is the idea that ethics can be logical, almost like mathematics.
Wait, math?
Yeah, Locke thinks that if we think hard enough about the concept of a creator, God, an omnipotent supreme being, and the concept of ourselves as rational but dependent beings, we can logically deduce our duties.
So just like I can deduce that a triangle has 180 degrees, just by understanding the definition of a triangle, I can deduce that I shouldn't murder you.
In theory, yes. Because murdering a fellow rational being created by the same God would be a logical contradiction of your own nature and your relationship to the creator.
Okay, that's the math approach. But that sounds like a lot of work for the average person. What's number two?
The second source is sensation and reflection. Or basically, experience. And this is where it gets really interesting, because Locke takes a bit of a utilitarian turn here. He says God has connected morality to our happiness.
Pleasure and pain?
Yes. Pleasure and pain are our teachers. We learn through experience that doing the right thing generally leads to well-being and happiness, and doing the wrong thing leads to misery.
It's practical. Like, honesty is the best policy, not just because it's holy, but because lying eventually blows up in your face and makes you miserable.
Exactly. It's a very pragmatic view of morality. But here is the irony that Holmes points out in the lecture. Locke was a devout Christian. He even wrote a book called The Reasonableness of Christianity.
Right.
But by arguing that we can figure out morality through reason, the first method and pleasure and pain, the second method, he accidentally opened a door he did not intend to open.
What door is that?
The door to deism and utilitarianism. Later thinkers looked at Locke's work and basically said, hey, thanks, John. If we can figure out right and wrong just by calculating pleasure and pain or by using strict logic, why do we need the Bible at all?
Oh, wow. He basically handed them the keys to a completely secular ethics.
He did. Yeah. Locke would have been horrified. For him, the third and supreme source of moral knowledge was biblical revelation. He thought the Bible was the final check on our reasoning. But his methods allowed later generations to cut the Bible out of the loop entirely.
That's the danger of being a pioneer, I guess. You build a road, and you don't get to decide who walks down it later.
A very apt metaphor.
Yeah.
He validated the tools that would eventually dismantle his own religious foundation.
So we've got a reasonable faith, and we've got ethics derived from experience and logic. Now let's move to the stuff he's really famous for, freedom and politics.
The top of the web.
Right. But Dr. Holmes points out something weird here in the source material. Locke doesn't think free will is a thing. That sounds wrong for the father of liberalism.
It's a tricky distinction, but it's crucial to understanding his politics. Locke thinks the phrase freedom of the will is meaningless. He calls it a category error.
That's just so.
He argues that the will is just a power, the power to prefer or choose. But a power can't be free. Only an agent, the person, can be free.
So I am free, but my will isn't.
Right. Locke argues that our preferences, what our will actually settles on, are caused by outside factors. He calls it uneasiness.
Uneasiness.
Yeah, you don't choose to be hungry. You don't choose to like the smell of bacon. Those are ideas coming in from the outside causing uneasiness until you satisfy them. So you aren't free in what you want.
I can't simply will myself to hate chocolate or love doing my taxes.
Correct. But Locke says we have freedom of action. You are free if you have the power to act on your desires. If you want chocolate and you are able to walk to the store and buy it, you are free. If you want to leave a room but the door is locked, you are not free.
So freedom isn't about the inside of my head. It's about the lack of chains on my body.
Precisely. And this definition, freedom of action, is the bridge to his politics. Because we are rational beings who need to act to survive and be happy, we have natural rights to exercise that freedom.
And this brings us to the state of nature. Picture it. No kings, no police, no laws, just people hanging out.
Right.
Hobbes, another philosopher we've looked at before, thought this would be a nightmare, a war of all against all. But Locke is more optimistic, isn't he?
He is. Locke argues that even in a state of nature, we aren't savages. We are rational beings with God-given rights. Mm-hmm. We're all equal and independent. And he identifies the big three, life, liberty, and property.
Life and liberty, I get, those are standard, but property. Locke is sometimes blamed for being the godfather of ruthless capitalism. You know, this is mine, keep out.
Oh, totally.
But Dr. Holmes says there's a nuance there that people miss.
A huge nuance. Locke argues that you gain property by mixing your labor with the land. If you farm a field, the crops are yours because your labor made them grow. But he puts a strict moral restriction on it, often called the Lockean proviso.
Which is?
You must leave enough and as good for others. And, equally important, you cannot take more than you can use.
The spoilage rule.
Right. If you hoard apples and let them rot while others starve, you haven't just been greedy. You have actually stolen from the common stock.
Wait, stolen? But I picked them.
It doesn't matter. The earth was given to humanity in common by God for our preservation. You only have a right to what you can use to sustain yourself. If it spoils, you violated the stewardship mandate.
That sounds a lot different than how he's usually portrayed. It's not boundless accumulation.
No, not at all. Holmes calls it a just usage theory. It's about sustaining life, not building an empire at the expense of others.
So, if we have these rights in nature, life, liberty, fair property, why do we need a government at all? Why not just stay in the woods?
Because not everyone follows the rule of reason. There are thieves. There are people who will try to enslave you. In the state of nature, you have the right to defend yourself. Locke is very clear on that. You can resist the thief.
But that's messy. Being your own policeman is a full-time job. And frankly, I might be a really bad judge of my own case.
Exactly. It's inefficient and dangerous. You might punish someone too harshly because you're angry. So we form a civil society, we make a contract, and this is the key difference from Hobbes.
Right, because for Hobbes, you surrender your rights to the king to save you from death. You give up liberty for security.
But not for Locke.
Right.
For Locke, you hire the government. It's a fiduciary trust. You give up your right to personally punish offenders. And in exchange, the government uses its power to preserve the rights you already have.
I really like the hiring analogy. So the government works for us.
It does. It's a trust. We give them the power to enforce the laws so we can go about our business, making contracts, getting married, running farms. The government is there to enhance our freedom, not to take it away.
And this leads to the most radical part of Locke's philosophy, the part that inspired revolutions. If I hire you, I can fire you.
That is the right to resist. If the government breaks the contract, if they start taking away your property arbitrarily or throwing you in jail without cause, they are no longer a legitimate government. They have put themselves in a state of war with the people.
And the people have a moral right, even a duty, to overthrow them.
Yes. And note the logic here. By resisting a tyrant, you aren't creating chaos. You are removing the agent of chaos. You are restoring the rule of reason.
It's amazing to think about. He built this entire logical structure from how a baby learns hot versus cold all the way up to let's decapitate the king if he breaks the law.
It's a staggering achievement.
And it all hangs on that one thread, reason.
It does. It's a beautiful, cohesive system. He uses the rule of reason to navigate faith, to determine ethics through pleasure and pain, and to build a government that exists solely to protect the rational freedom of the individual.
So let's zoom out for a second. What does this all mean for us today? We still use his language. We talk about human rights. We talk about evidence-based thinking. But does the system still hold up?
That is the big question Dr. Holmes leaves us to ponder at the end of the lecture. You see, Locke assumed that science and religion were compatible because he thought science described a stable, objective reality.
Okay.
He lived in the time of Newton. The universe was a giant clock, and we could see the gears. Reason was a universal constant.
But science has gotten a lot weirder since the 1600s.
It has. Holmes mentions the Kuhnian Revolution, the idea from Thomas Kuhn that science goes through paradigm shifts. And today, we have massive philosophical debates about scientific realism versus anti-realism.
Meaning what, exactly?
Yeah. Meaning, is science actually describing objective reality? Or is it just our current best model, deeply influenced by our culture and our language?
And science is subjective.
Exactly. If science turns out to be more subjective, influenced by culture and paradigms, then Locke's reasonable faith loses its anchor. Locke wanted a faith that stood on the solid rock of objective reason. But if that rock is actually shifting sand, where does that leave us?
That is a very provocative thought for everyone listening to chew on. We're running on Locke software, but the hardware of our understanding of the universe has completely changed. Can you still have self-evident rights in a postmodern world?
It raises the question, can you still be a Lockean today? Or do we need a completely new way to connect our beliefs to our evidence?
Something to think about the next time you hear someone arguing about natural rights or following the science. We might be living in a Lockean house while the foundation is slowly cracking underneath us.
Indeed. It is certainly worth considering.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the mind of John Locke. We'll catch you on the next one.
Goodbye.